is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's Big Picture. And this week, we're going to look at the bigger picture when it comes to the nation's debt. We set a record this week, but sadly, it's not the kind of record we like to see. This week, the national debt rose to $22 trillion. Congress will soon need to act to extend the nation's debt limits beyond where we are this week, and it will have to be raised substantially since the deficits are now approaching $1 trillion annually. And we're not even in a recession. Now, federal tax revenue declined 0.4% last year to roughly $3.33 trillion, while expenses rose to $4.2 trillion. That is an increase of 4.4% over the previous year. Now, part of the reason for this number being so large is the tax cuts, also additional government spending, and higher interest rates being paid on the government debt. Already, the deficit for the government's fiscal year, 2019, is running ahead of last year, $319 billion versus $225 billion. That's up, get this, 43% over the previous year. So at the moment, there's not much talk about the deficit or the national debt for some reason, but we're here to alert you that there will be soon much more talk in the near future as we'll be back to trillion-dollar deficits. In fact, interest on the debt is rising as a result of Fed rate hikes, so interest expense is also rising, unlike the past where interest expense fell as national debt grew due to the Fed's zero interest rate policy.
Wall Street to dramatic losses today, the worst in 8 months. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 831 points, or 3%, to close at 25,598. The NASDAQ fell 316.
Economy, hyped to be kind of the antagonist of the marketplace, kind of the Joe Walsh of the economy. Higher rates are the bad boy. But really, they're not, okay? What is going on with rates is not only something that is unexpected. We should welcome it.
So, Jim, let's talk about the consequences and what lies ahead in our future.
You know, this is an interesting topic to be discussing right now because you don't hear any talk about the deficits in Washington, either party, Chris, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. In fact, there's a new philosophy going along. It's called modern monetary policy, which basically says you can raise and spend as much as you like as long as you do it in your own currency. But I want to put this debt into perspective because a lot of people, well, you hear the debt. Well, what does that mean for me? Well, let me put it into a personal perspective. As a citizen of the U.S., that debt translates into roughly $69,000 per person. The latest figures we have are for 2017, when the national debt was $20 trillion. It's $22 trillion this week, so that figure of $69,000 is roughly about 10% higher, so it's going to be much, much larger than what we're talking about now. Chris, how many people in your family?
Me, my wife, and two kids.
Okay, collectively, your family owes $280,000. So, I mean,
who do I make the check out to?
Well, the Treasury, but I mean, serious, I mean, this is an issue we're probably going to be dealing with in our future, and it's the crowding out in the debt markets as the government will need to finance a greater portion of its debt at a time, for example, China, Japan, and the Fed are buying less U.S. government bonds. Now, right now, it's mainly been institutions and individuals that have stepped in, and so interest rates have been relatively low. At least they've come down from where they were when they peaked in November of last year. Now, the other factor is that interest costs are going to start rising exponentially. By next year, interest on the national debt will be larger than what the government spends on Medicaid. And check this out. By 2023, it's going to be larger than the entire national defense budget. And we're spending over $700 billion to put that into perspective. And by 2025, it's going to consume more than the entire discretionary budget of the U.S. government. Right now, roughly about a little over 60-65% is spent on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, interest on the debt. The rest is what it costs to run the government, the military, the court systems, politicians, the parks, everything that the government does. So in the next couple of years, all you're going to hear about is the debt in the looming debt crisis. Nobody's talking about now, because right now we're in silly season, and this is the time when politicians promise, you know, they kiss babies and give us lollipops and tell us all these wonderful things they're going to do.
Well, but aren't there other nations, Jim, that have a larger amount of debt in terms of in relation to their GDP than the United States? So can't this go on for much longer, technically, than maybe we might be thinking?
Well, there are countries that have a larger amount of debt in relation to their economy. What comes to mind, Japan, China are examples of this. And Chris, if you think you owe a lot at $69,000, the average Japanese citizen owes $90,000. Italy has a large amount of debt in relation to its economy and could be on the brink unless the ECB steps in to bail out the country like they did with Greece back in 2011. So yes, the debt can certainly get larger than it is today. And one of the advantages we have is our own currency is the world's reserve currency. So we can raise debt in our own currency. It creates a problem, and you've seen this in Turkey, Argentina, where countries have to borrow in other currencies on their debt. And that runs into a problem when their own currency gets debased. So the theory, at least the thinking is here, hey, we're sort of the exception. We're the world's reserve currency. Therefore, we can borrow as much as we want. But yes, the debt can get certainly larger than it is today, but the problems are starting to show up as they did last year when rates rose instead of falling during a stock market correction. That happened in February of last year. It happened in October. It was only until we got to about December when everybody was worried about, wow, we could be going into a major slowdown with the Fed talking very hawkish that you saw interest rates come back down. In fact, there are some experts out there like Jeffrey Gundlach at DoubleLine who thinks during the next downturn, rates could actually rise instead of fall. There's some different thinking out of the box for you that rates rise instead of fall because of the magnitude of the debt. Because right now, we're running $1 trillion, and that's with the economy growing at 3%. What happens when we get into a recession?
It's just so interesting. I check the headlines all the time, and I'm not hearing about this. You'd think this would be the national emergency that everyone's talking about if you're looking at the current headlines. But why do you think this becomes a problem much sooner than most people are talking about? I mean, outside of a few news sources, and I mean very few, it just doesn't seem like people are talking about this subject at all.
No, because the debt is much bigger and both parties are in the spending mode. The president enacted his tax bill, which was $1.5 trillion. That was followed up by Congress with $300 billion of additional spending. And also, Chris, we are in an election cycle. Can you imagine a politician running for office saying, if you vote for me, I'm going to cut your Social Security benefits, make you pay more for Medicare, and I'm going to take away some of the goodies that we give you. That would never fly. What do politicians do when they're running for office? They promise the voters all kinds of benefits. And that the reason, I think, is that when it comes to interest expense, and we take a look at the way we look at budget figures, and there's all kinds of sleight of hand that goes on in Washington. Coming from an accounting background, I want to explain a couple of them. One figure is the total interest the government pays on all of its debt, and that's both public and private. Now, the public debt figure is the debt that is traded publicly. So if you want to buy treasury bills, savings bonds, if institutions or mutual funds want to buy government bonds or foreigners, that's what we call the public debt. It's individuals, institutions, and foreign governments that own that. Now, that figure stood at almost $16 trillion at the end of the government's fiscal year in 2018, which ended in September. Now, the other debt is the debt the government owes itself, like the debt it owes to, for example, the Social Security Trust Fund and other various government trust funds. That figure is close to $6 trillion. So that's how we get the $22 trillion, Chris. $16 trillion is publicly traded debt, and $6 trillion the government is IOUs that owe Social Security and other trust funds. So if you look at, and this is a very important figure, if you look at the total interest expense last year, it was $523 billion. That's why in three more years, interest on the debt is going to be over $750 billion. But the public portion, the portion they pay on the $16 trillion, that was $310 billion in interest. The other $213 billion is what the government owes the trust fund. Basically, it issues IOUs on that money, and it spends a lot of the money that Social Security was taking in during the surplus years. The government would use that, spend the money, and then issue an IOU in the cookie jar. There is no trust fund, like, for example, in Canada, where the Canadian Pension Fund actually owns assets, stocks, bonds, real estate, real assets. So the $523 billion, think of it this way, that's a lot of money to spend on interest. That is money that cannot be spent on infrastructure or other needs of government, and that figure is rising rapidly. And Chris, that's where the problems are going to be created, because the government has entitlements. They have to, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all of that rising with the boomers heading into retirement. And as the public portion, as that interest expense keeps rising, it's going to squeeze out other expenditures. So, in fact, in that clip, in that report, the CBO talks about that soon, in the next decade, the public portion, and this is just the public portion of interest expense, will rise to almost 13% of the government's total budget. So you add 13% on top of 65%, and then you have defense, and you can see where we're going to be in trouble. In fact, it's widely known. In fact, we had somebody from Social Security on lifetime income where she said, look, by 2033, if nothing changes, we will have to reduce Social Security benefits by 25%. There simply will not be enough money to pay out full benefits. So at some point in the next decade, early on, we're going to be facing severe debt and budget problems. And this is not an issue that politicians are going to be able to kick the can down the road, as it's going to be on their doorstep. And that is why now that we are in the middle of silly season, do not, as a voter, believe the promise is now being made. You're going to get free college. Everybody's going to get free Medicare for all. Everybody's going to get a living wage for everyone working, or if you decide not to work. That is nothing more than pipe dreams and promises. There's simply not the money available to pay for these promises. Medicare and Social Security are already going to be short of funds in the next decade, much more so if our politicians make these kinds of promises to win elections. And that's the scary part about all of this, is that there are very few economic literate congressmen or congresswomen in our capital. The U.S. has always been able to, in most cases, print and borrow money in its own currency, because we are the world's reserve currency. And that's most likely going to change in the next decade, as more countries spearheaded by China, Russia, and others are trying to circumvent using the dollar. Now, if our finances deteriorate, as they are now doing, this effort will be speeded up.
That brings me to my next question, Jim, because when you think about, everyone seems to be talking about a slowdown, maybe a recession this year or next. What happens in the next recession when the government revenues actually fall dramatically? Because usually there's quite a bit of spending that has to be done to stimulate the economy under those circumstances. So if expenses increase and deficits balloon beyond $1 trillion, where does the money come from to re-stimulate the economy? And also, with interest rates this low, will slashing rates to zero again really get the economy going once more?
This is a subject that we're doing research on in our firm, and we think this becomes a major issue, as I mentioned, in the next decade, not just here, but also in the U.S., but also globally. We're not the only ones that are heading for bigger debt issues. We're getting a hint already as to how the Fed may react. Don't think they're sitting by idly and not thinking about this very thing. One reason the Fed has been raising interest rates these last few years, because a lot of people are saying, why are they raising interest rates? The economy isn't overheating. We don't have a lot of inflation out there. And yes, the unemployment's low, but wages aren't skyrocketing. So with all this going on, Why are they doing it, especially with anemic economic growth until recently? The reason they're doing it is they know if dropping interest rates from 5% to zero, as they did during the financial crisis, if that did not do the trick, and it took trillions of dollars of QE to bring down long-term interest rates, they already know they're going to have a problem. Now, here was a key thing that also went unnoticed. Just as the $22 trillion in debt this week went unnoticed, a report that came out by the San Francisco Fed last week entitled, "How Much Could Negative Interest Rates Have Helped the Recovery?" The paper lays out the case for actually going below zero and making interest rates negative, just as we saw happen, for example, in European government bonds. In fact, even on this week, if you look at two-year debt in Germany, Spain, and Japan, it's still actually negative, meaning if you buy those government bonds or those two-year notes of those governments, you are going to loan the government money and you're going to have to pay them. So imagine buying a bond where you make less money than what you originally invested in. So according to this new Fed paper, a negative interest rate ranging from a negative quarter of a point to a negative three quarters of a point would do the trick. Now, according to the Fed's models, negative interest rates would stimulate the economy much faster than a zero rate. People would be, for example, less inclined to keep their money in cash if banks charge them interest on their deposits. According to the models, in theory, individuals would be motivated to either spend the money or go invest their money rather than leave it idle and unproductive. Now, you may not have been aware of this, but at the institutional level, coming out of the last financial crisis when rates got down to zero, if you were a large company and you were keeping large amounts of cash at a bank, they actually charged you interest because they weren't loaning. So here is a hint as to what they're already thinking about. With limited ability to raise interest rates much further as a result of there's just simply too much debt in our economy, they're thinking of going negative, just like we see today in Europe and Japan.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
So, Jim, let's assume that at some point, and whether it's late this year or the next, but let's assume that the Fed raises interest rates and we eventually go into a recession. What happens next with rates this low? And also the fact that you've got a federal debt that's now gone beyond $22 trillion.
You know, like if we take a look at the recessions of 2001 and 2007, you will see some form of fiscal stimulus combined with monetary stimulus. We saw that with George W. Bush, that was, in the 2001 recession. They had tax cuts, they had tax credits, all kinds of things, and then the Fed just simply lowered interest rates. The only problem outside of monetary stimulus so often is government stimulus can lead to malinvestments as it did in the last decade in terms of what happened in the real estate market. They passed laws encouraging banks to make loans to people that really couldn't afford to make the interest payments. And, you know, the best form of stimulus are tax cuts. Let the market direct where that investment needs to be made. The government, and most governments, are a poor judge of capital allocation. The best example is the green stimulus in the last administration that led to the misuse of funds and bankruptcy. But this is nothing new. It's been done by governments throughout the centuries with poor results.
And for our listeners, Jim, you just wrote an article on our site that references a financial crisis in the Roman Empire in, believe it or not, 33 AD that involved efforts to stimulate real estate that had the opposite effect. it depressed real estate prices, led to a credit crisis, and it eventually was solved by quantitative easing. And Jim, it's just amazing how this has actually been done before. Why don't you share a few highlights of your article? I know that when our staff got a sneak peek at the article, there was just a lot of discussion about it. It's, at the risk of sounding dramatic, it's kind of a jaw-dropping article. Would you share a few highlights with our listeners?
Yeah, as I mentioned, we're doing a lot of internal studies right now on the next debt crisis, and we'll get to some good sources for that. And I began doing a lot of research, and I was looking at debt crises through the centuries over time, looking for many of the parallels. You know, Ray Dalio's book, Big Debt Crises, covers a lot of them in the 20th century. What I was looking for in the past, because I know we've had them. And we had them in France, we had them, which eventually led to the French Revolution, we had them in Russia. And so I was looking back, and then I discovered, you know, in 33 AD, there are so many similarities in terms of what happened then to today's financial markets with government intervention. Let me just give you a little background here. It goes back to Julius Caesar, who attempted to, they were trying to set interest rates, kind of cap them the way the Fed did coming out of World War II. And they capped them at 12%. Now, Caesar basically came in and said, look, the people that are in the lending business, you must have at least a third of your investments in land, with agriculture being the main industry of the empire outside of trade. So it made a lot of sense that the government said, look, you can loan money. We want to make sure at least of a third of it goes into agriculture, because that's what drives the economy. Now, that law faded after his death, but it remained on the books. Well, fast forward to 33 AD, Italian land values fell after a period of retribution of a particular consul of Rome by the name of Sejanus. He was basically head of the Praetorian Guards. He became a consul of Rome, and he was a favorite of Tiberius. Well, he was plotting to become the next emperor, and of course, and Tiberius's successor. Well, the plot was discovered. He was tried and executed along with his followers, but the government came in and confiscated their lands. Now, what happened is this eventually led to a contraction of money supply, depressed real estate prices, and a weakening economy. So, like any government, just like we do today, the Senate comes in an effort to revitalize real estate. They resurrected the old one-third rule, and they gave wealthy senators, who were the main wealth in the empire, 18 months to comply. Now, they ignored it at first until we got towards the end when the government sought compliance, and it created a panic. Senators began calling in their loans, selling assets to raise cash to comply with the law, contracting the money supply and depressing real estate prices further. What does government do? Typical government. The plan wasn't working, so they doubled down. They said, instead of one-third of your investments in real estate, we're going to raise that to two-thirds. This produced, obviously, the opposite effect, depressing prices further. Now, what ended up happening was a bank run as capital was called on. Like today, the banking system was interconnected. So as bad loans went sour at one bank, it rippled throughout the system because that particular bank might have been invested in another bank. And it rippled throughout the Roman Empire from Egypt to the Middle East all the way to Rome itself. The banking system froze. Capital became scarce. Think of what happened here in the fall of 2008 with the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers and the domino effect it had on the rest of our, let's say, financial institutions that either went under, like AIG, or had to be merged and bailed out like Merrill Lynch. You remember or recall in the fall of 2008, TARP, the Asset Relief Protection Program, and then eventually, of course, in March of 2009, nothing was working and the Fed resorted to quantitative easing to solve the crisis. Now, here's the thing that you're going to find interesting. That's exactly what happened in Rome. The whole system froze. You had a panic. You had a banking crisis with one Roman bank after another going under. In the way it was solved, the emperor freed up 100 million sesterces, the Roman coin of the realm, from the treasury and lent it to banking houses with the instructions the money was to be lent out at a zero interest rate for a period of 3 years. What did it do? It restored confidence in lending. But the downside of that, to pay for it, the emperor went after his enemies, putting them to death and confiscating their lands and properties. So, no surprise, what are you hearing today? You're hearing raising tax rates to 70%, a wealth tax of 2 to 3%, raising Social Security tax by an additional 2.5% with no cap on salaries, trillions of dollars of carbon taxes, gasoline taxes, numerous other proposals, including nationalizing the energy industry. The amazing thing is you read these crises, and that was one of the things I'm getting ready to write a couple of series of major articles, is I looked at these crises over time going back to the Roman Empire. Of course, there's nothing new. A lot of this stuff has been done before. But what happens is government gets heavily in debt, they look for scapegoats and a new source of revenue, including confiscatory taxation. Today's new scapegoat is the rich who paid the bulk of the nation's taxes. I want to just read something from Tacitus, who is a Roman historian. Does this sound familiar? Following these, the richest man in the Spanish provinces, Sextus Marius, was denounced for having had incestuous relations with his daughter, and he was thrown down from the Tarpeian Rock. And to leave no doubt that it was really the extent of the man's wealth that had brought about his downfall, Tiberius set aside his gold and silver mines for himself, although they were state confiscations. And then it goes on, basically the emperor went after a lot of Sejanus' followers, basically trying them, putting them to death, and confiscating the land.
Well, that's what he gets for having Sextus Marius. You know, it never fails. But on a serious note, Jim, it really is a fascinating story, and our listeners can read it on financialsense.com. It's just an article you don't want to miss. Now, I know the firm is now doing research on debt crises and how they unfold and what works when they happen. Jim, what do you see in the future, though? I mean, especially with a presidential election coming up in less than 2 years.
You know, I'm calling the 2020 election the lots of free stuff that other people pay for election. I mean, you think about it. I mean, both parties are doing this. I mean, just remember that, folks. Lots of free stuff that other people pay for. And a lot will depend on whether we remain, I don't know, capitalistic or move far left and become socialistic. We're looking at two completely different outcomes here. My personal belief is that I feel most Americans would be leery of a government-run economy. But that's just my view. A lot, Chris, is going to depend on what the economy looks like next year, the state of the markets, and what the unemployment picture looks like. If the economy and markets are doing well, the incumbent tends to get reelected. If the economy is in a recession, the stock market is down, unemployment is rising, that tends to favor the challenger. For example, when Bill Clinton challenged George H. Bush, what did we see? And this is what I find rather fascinating, the similarities between George H. Bush and Donald Trump. The Fed began to raise interest rates in the last 2 years of George H. Bush's presidency. What had happened? It resulted in a recession in 1990 and 91. Unemployment went up, the stock market corrected, and the economy was into a recession. Guess what? He lost the election. So if Trump is smart, he works on another stimulus plan, perhaps maybe it's infrastructure, where there seems to be an agreement between the two parties. He resolves the trade war between China and maybe jawbones the Fed to refrain, from raising interest rates. The Fed tends to back off making any major policy moves during an election year. For example, as Yellen did in 2016, she started the year she was going to raise interest rates. She waited till after the election in December of 2016 before she raised rates, as did Bernanke. So, however, whatever the course, we think the next cycle is going to be inflationary. You know, $22 trillion growing at over $1 trillion a year. There's just too much government debt. Interest costs are growing at double digits per year and for the remainder of the next decade. We are now at $22 trillion. Growing at $1 trillion per year, and it may even get bigger. Now, as I mentioned earlier, interest on the debt will consume all discretionary spending by the government by the year 2025. Now, that's coming from the CBO, and Chris, that's assuming no recession. In fact, there's a new monetary policy I mentioned earlier being floated in Congress right now. It's called New Monetary Policy. It proposes there is no limit to the debt issuance as long as it's done in your own currency. So both Congress and the Fed have telegraphed, in some ways, what is going to happen in the next down cycle, a topic we are studying and doing a lot of research. I want to recommend, for those of you who want to get a glimpse of what the next decade is going to look like, there's a series of books out there. One is free. I got it free. We talked about it last year, but I bought the printed version from Amazon, and that's by hedge fund manager Ray Dalio, who runs the world's largest hedge fund and who remains defensively positioned, by the way, including positions in gold. Now, he wrote a book called Principles for Navigating the Big Debt Crisis. And I recommend if you, well, you can go to the site and we're going to give it out and you can get it free. But the written book you can get on Amazon. It comes in a binder sort of, and it's three parts. Part one, the big debt crisis. Part two, detailed case studies. And part three, a compendium of 48 case studies. 24 of them are inflationary. 24 of them are deflationary. It's absolutely must reading if you want to get a feel what they look like and how they unfold. Another book I recommend is A History of Business Depressions by Otto Leitner. And even Otto talks about the Romans in 33 AD.
Well, Jim, I want to play a few clips here from Ray Dalio and also the response from the financial community to his book. I think our listeners will find this quite compelling.
Of all of them, there's the debt growth that finances the bubbles that happen before it that create the busts. You know, there's basically six stages to it. There's the normal debt growth that finances growth that pays for itself. Then you get into the bubble stage when everybody's extrapolating what happened in the past. So asset prices are going up and everybody's borrowing a lot of money to extrapolate what's happened. And that bubble stage, central banks don't pay much attention to because it doesn't affect inflation and growth. And so I think at that stage is when the central bank should be looking at, are those debts going to be able to be paid back from the financial?
All right, I want to ask you about something he said there, and I didn't hear whether he answered and followed through or not this morning. He said when things go bluey, it won't be like the same in terms of the big bang debt crisis. It'll be a slower growing, more constricting debt crisis, but it will have, I think, bigger social implications and bigger international implications. That sounds pretty ominous to me. What is he driving at there, Art, if you can draw some surmises?
Yeah, I think the three things he's really bringing to bear in that statement really have to do with the disparity of wealth that we have. We've never seen a larger disparity of wealth from top to bottom. I think that's a large and growing issue. I think that, you know, that's something that needs to be, you know, looked at very directly by policymakers. I think the second thing really speaks more to how much global debt there is. And I think he's less concerned about the debt to GDP ratio in the United States, but a lot of the emerging market debt that's dollar denominated in an environment where we'll probably continue to see strengthening dollar, that gets even larger. And the third thing I think is, what to do with European debt, especially with a lot of the hotspots going on, whether it's Italy or Turkey or, you know, any of the things that, you know, some of the European banks are exposed to. So my guess is, you know, it's a combination of wealth disparity that's clear and present in terms of danger and a lot of global debt and a lot of that that's dollar denominated, which continues to get worse before it gets better in terms of strength of the dollar.
With all of that concern, Jim, how do you prepare for events like this? And I guess, where do you think we are now?
You know, a lot depends on what happens politically. So much of what has happened in this recovery has been driven by the government, whether it's monetary or fiscal policy. I mean, look what happened in 2009 with fiscal and monetary stimulus, then the introduction of QE1, QE2, and QE3. Trump comes to the presidency, the economy's growing. He introduces a massive stimulus towards the end of a business cycle. And we may get even more before the next election. Then there's the election itself and the outcome. We stay in our present course or move closer to socialism with different outcomes for each approach. So there's a great divide in the country right now. And if you want to navigate the next cycle, you're going to have to put your political views aside, as they may blindside you as to the appropriate course of action to take. I mean, we still remain defensive unless the three risks we identified are removed, which is, number one, a policy mistake by the Fed. And right now, they've recently done a 180 on their strident views of, let's say, last fall in interest rates. Nothing like a major market correction to get their attention. The second one, which may be resolved here pretty soon, is the trade war, which I expect to get resolved, and that will remove another major uncertainty. Finally, there's political discord. As we are doing this broadcast, it looks like they're going to pass a budget bill that the president signed. So if we see, for example, more cooperation and compromise, then maybe that obstacle gets resolved as well. But next year, the Democrats will produce a candidate and a platform that will get closely scrutinized as to whether it's, for example, business or economic friendly, Or is it hostile, which the market would not like? So I don't think I can ever remember a time in my career where the political outcome plays such a large role on the markets and economic outcomes. It's likely to remain that way as our deficits widen and the government keeps piling on debt. So from my perspective, Chris, we believe the next cycle is going to be inflationary. One of the reasons I like gold and oil here, and we're not alone. If you take a look at the latest Q filings for Bridgewater, they own gold as well.
Well, it's definitely something that we're going to be talking about because it obviously plays such a large role in terms of the market and economic outcomes. So before we finish this segment, I just want to remind our listeners to go to financialsense.com and just click on the article. It's 33 AD. There's nothing new under the sun. Also, Jim did reference Ray Dalio's book. You can go to the Bridgewater website for that book or on Amazon at www.principles.com/big-debt-crises. Well, Jim, we covered a lot of ground on this episode. What do you see coming up in the weeks ahead?
Well, we got a couple things. We have the debt ceiling debate coming up. We have a FOMC meeting coming up in March. Nobody expects anything to change with the Fed, probably to continue, hey, we're going to sit back and wait for a while. And then also, we're going to be ending the first quarter. So what's going to be interesting is, let's say the last couple of weeks before March ends, what companies are saying about first quarter earnings. Now, the economy has slowed down. We had the government shutdown. And even as we got through the fourth quarter of last year, a lot of companies, Apple was missing its sales. So it'll be interesting to see what companies say. And are we seeing an earnings downturn in slowdown? Because that's, as we look at some of these numbers, we think that's what's going to happen in the first quarter. So we'll be looking out for that. Also, you're going to get some economic numbers coming out. Well, we'd have to wait to April before we start getting the Q1 numbers on the economy to see if this slowdown continues or do we start doing what we typically do in the second quarter. And that is the second quarter and third quarter tends to be the highest growth quarters for the year. So all that's coming up. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.